This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, more speculation over what happened to that Russian jetliner that crashed in Egypt. A rare weather event in Yemen leaves widespread damage. Tis the season for harvesting mint.
So we grow peppermint and spearmint, and there's two types of spearmint. There's what they call the native spearmint, and then they have a Scotch, what they call a Scotch spearmint.
A new Broadway musical about a Grammy-winning husband and wife team gets ready to open. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. A U.S. military satellite detected a heat flash at the time a Russian jetliner crashed over the Sinai Peninsula last weekend, but the cause of the accident remains a mystery. Authorities have ruled out the possibility that a missile hit the aircraft before it broke into pieces and plunged 9,400 meters to the Sinai Desert, killing all 224 people aboard. Neither a missile launch nor engine burn was detected. But experts told U.S. media outlets that the heat flash could point to a catastrophic event aboard the aircraft, such as an exploding bomb, the explosion of an aircraft engine, or a fire aboard the Metrojet A321, or even just the aircraft parts hitting the ground. Todd Curtis is with the online publication AirSafe, which is devoted to airline safety and security information. He told International Edition's Victor Beatty it is too early to determine a cause, but expects the coming days will reveal vital information.
Absent the information from the recorders and other information from the wreckage itself, it's entirely premature to state what the cause of this crash was. No official investigative body has stated anything from the factual data that's been collected that would support that particular theory.
Where does this all lead us right now? The Associated Press says mystery, confusion surround the Russian plane crash in Egypt. Are we lacking answers right now?
Oh, we're certainly lacking answers because the investigation is only in the earliest stages. Fortunately, the black boxes were both recovered. They're in the preliminary stage of being analyzed. It's unclear whether or not there's useful data on there yet, but I'm sure within a few days, at least that amount of information will be presented to the public. Now, beyond that, there is quite a bit of information from the wreckage itself that has yet to be analyzed in any great detail, either by the Egyptian authorities, the Airbus authorities, or the Russian authorities. So I believe that there is ample technological prowess being brought to bear in this particular situation, from the analysis of the wreckage to the analysis of the black boxes to the analysis of all the other data associated with this flight. And I'm sure that within a few weeks' time, there will be much more clarity as to the sequence of events that ended with the airplane on the desert floor.
Todd, the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, Monday said he knew of no direct evidence terrorism was to blame for this crash.
Well, given that he is the head of the organization that manages both the CIA and the NSA, and also the intelligence units of the military, I'm assuming that this person has access to the best intelligence the U.S. has to offer. Given that this event occurred over the Sinai, which has been an area of intense interest of the U.S. military and intelligence communities for several generations, I'm fairly confident that there are a number of assets that are trained on that area 24/7, and that if there were anything that were consistent with, let's say, a missile being launched or with something that is a large-scale explosion, that they might have spotted that. Now, exactly what the U.S. intelligence community has spotted isn't clear, and I don't expect them to provide any detailed explanation anytime soon. But that is a very telling statement. The U.S., although it is a partner in the investigation, the U.S. intelligence community is not one of the direct partners involved in this. And to have that high-level official say something publicly means that, in my opinion, the U.S. government is trying to get a message across to someone.
Todd Curtis, the online publication AirSafe, speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Russian families have started the sad process of identifying 140 bodies that were transported home to St. Petersburg. A rare cyclone slammed into southeastern Yemen Tuesday. The World Meteorological Organization warns torrential rains are expected to follow Cyclone Chapala, leaving a severe and destructive impact. Lisa Schlein has details.
Chapala, a rare tropical cyclone with a wind speed of up to 130 kilometers an hour, made landfall Tuesday on Yemen's southern coast, then quickly ran out of steam. The World Meteorological Organization reports the cyclone weakened rapidly as it moved westward because of rugged terrain and dry air. But spokeswoman Claire Nellis says the WMO fears the destructive power of the storm's rains.
There have been various reports, you know, that Yemen could get the equivalent of 6 years, the equivalent of 10 years of rainfall. It's very difficult to actually quantify it. I think the main point to underline is that Yemen is normally a very arid area. It doesn't have the infrastructure to cope, so we really do expect this cyclone to have a very significant impact.
Nellis says it is not possible to forecast the intensity or duration of the rains because there's no functioning meteorological system in Yemen. She tells VOA the rugged mountainous terrain is likely to trigger devastating landslides.
The one thing that I didn't touch on before is the seas. We've seen very, very, very high waves. That obviously will have had an impact on shipping and on fishermen. I hope that's not a route that the migrants use because, they obviously won't have been forewarned or prepared for it.
The World Health Organization says in preparation for the storm, it has delivered trauma kits for 1,000 patients in the southern coastal district of Mukalla. The UN agency says it also is providing fuel for 8 hospitals and 16 ambulances in the war-torn country, which is short of fuel, medicine, and other essential supplies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And now time for a look at the world of social media. There's something new buzzing, and here's G. Abby Lee to fill us in. Hi, G.
Hello, Ray.
G, what is the big story today online?
It has to do with a change on Twitter. Whenever I introduce a popular tweet in this segment, I mention how many times it's been shared and marked as a favorite. But going forward, I'll have to mention how many times it's been shared and how many times it's been hearted.
Hearted. Well, that's an interesting word. What's mm-hmm. that mean?
Twitter's favorite button, which was in the shape of a star, has been replaced with a little heart symbol. It's still the same concept of marking a tweet you like, but just in a different format. Many media outlets are tweeting about the change, and they include the Forbes magazine, BBC News, and MarketWatch.
Let's hear from one of them.
Sure. MarketWatch tweeted this. Twitter ditched its star icon and favorite button and replaced it with a heart.
It seems like such a minor change, almost unnecessary, really. What's the reason behind all of this?
Well, Twitter's product manager wrote about it in a blog post. He wrote, "You might like a lot of things, but not everything can be your favorite." And he added, "Unlike a star, the heart is a universal symbol."
A lot of social media sites then are using the heart symbol now?
Absolutely. Facebook's Instagram app and Twitter's live streaming app called Periscope use a heart symbol. Twitter also revealed it will change the symbol and terminology in its Fine app.
And what's the public's reaction to this big change?
For that, I have a tweet that's getting more than 1,000 retweets. It's by a user named Peter Siebel, and it reads like this. "I work at Twitter, but even I can believe how we replace a completely value-neutral term like favorite with something so loaded." He sent out another tweet later writing, "I heart people who understand irony," confirming that he was in fact being sarcastic in his earlier tweet. Back to you.
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at GABBYLEY. That's JEEABBYLEE. Or on our VOA International Edition Twitter account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com for 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Rising tuition costs at colleges and universities have long been a big issue for students and their families. My colleague Jim Stevenson speaks with hashtag VOA co-host Michael Lippin about a recent series of student protests.
South African universities have been returning to normal after more than a week of student protests against plans to raise tuition fees that many of them cannot afford. The sometimes violent protests caused several major South African universities to shut down briefly last month. These protests were the focus of our latest hashtag VOA TV program, which was broadcast earlier today. And I'm joined in the studio by its co-host, Michael Lippin.
Hey, Jim.
Hi. Michael, what's the latest on the situation in South Africa?
Hey, Jim. Well, I can tell you that those protests subsided last week after South African President Jacob Zuma agreed to the students' main demand and ordered a freeze on tuition fees for 2016. But some students complain that the government's pledge does not go far enough. One of them appeared on our show. Her name is Leanne Naidu. She's an activist at Wits University in Johannesburg, where annual undergraduate tuition is around $3,000. Here's what she said about the issue.
Look, I think the way we need to start is by acknowledging that South Africa is the most unequal society in the world. So for half or for some of our society, that amount doesn't sound like much. But there are a whole range of students who would struggle and even not be able to afford those kind of fees. And then we must recognize that fees obviously differ from institution to institution. I think what has come about with the Fees Must Fall movement is a strong outcry to say that we need good quality education, higher education, for people who can't afford it. That this, there's a big debate going on now about whether free quality education should be available to everyone. And under the current conditions, people are saying that we have to make sure that people who can't afford it are able to access higher education. So the question, I couldn't answer it easily. For me, it's maybe not that much money, but for a whole range of people, specifically people who are trying to make it out of dire poverty, it's completely unaffordable for them.
Well, another guest on our show was an American retired history professor at State University of New York, Lawrence Whitner. I asked him how the financial pressures on South Africa's students compare to those facing Americans here in the U.S. Let's have a listen to what he said.
Well, it's very similar in many ways. Dating back to the 19th century, the United States had free public higher education. And in fact, that went on free or virtually free until the 1960s, when the average tuition at a public university or college in the United States was only $243 per year. The University of California system was free until the 1980s. But that's been dramatically changing in recent decades, when tuition has been dramatically hiked up, and today is beyond the means of most college students and their families to pay for it. And so the average student today in the United States has a debt of $30,000 after completing college.
That's a staggering amount. And if you want to find out more about that issue, check out the hashtag VOA Facebook page and watch the show.
Hashtag VOA co-host Michael Lippin speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. On yesterday's program, we heard from Dr. John Dye, the chief of the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, Viral Immunology Branch, about the advances in Ebola research and treatment. International Edition Susan Yaki continues the conversation by asking him about safety precautions in trying to study the Ebola virus.
It's not something that we just bring someone off the streets and pull them in and throw them into a high containment suite. So I personally have gone through years of training with mentors and experts to develop my technique to be able to be safe working with these viruses and bacteria, as do all of my comrades here at USAMRID. And when we bring someone in, they really part of the team, they become part of the team, and you really have to develop a trust when you're working side by side with these individuals in a high containment suite. So training and trust are the two T's that I talk about when I talk about how we go forward working with these viruses and bacteria.
I can remember that when we first started talking about Ebola, there were so many people who were scared that this was going to go all over the world, that it was going to spread because there was no way to stop it. What is your feeling about that?
So I think we worry about viruses and bacteria becoming pandemics, spreading all over the world. This was an epidemic. It spread into multiple countries in Western Africa. Honestly, Ebola isn't really that good, if you want to put quotation marks, of a virus when it comes to what it's supposed to do, because it actually kills its host. A virus isn't actually very good, if you speak in that manner, when it actually kills the organism that it's using to spread itself. So a virus is basically genetic material encapsulated in an envelope, and it uses your or my cells within our body to produce more copies of itself. And so if it kills the person or the cells that it's using to actually spread itself, it's really not that good. So Ebola and viruses, hemorrhagic fever viruses like this, they tend to burn out rather quickly. This was a very different case in Western Africa, and we can discuss that later if you'd like. But so it's not that great a virus when it comes to that. So I wasn't concerned about it becoming a pandemic, per se, spreading all over the world. But we now live in an age with globalization and transportation, which is at an all-time high, where you have the ability to jump on a plane and be anywhere in 8 to 12 hours. So there's a latency period, or a period where the virus is ramping up production in the person or the animal that is infected. So you don't really know you're infected, and then maybe you hop on a plane, you head to London, you head to New York, you head to Dallas, Texas, which is exactly what happened in the U.S., and you potentially have a possibility where you could get a spread into different countries.
And you mentioned Africa.
I did. So there's a great concern of it spreading within Africa. The reason why is because the infrastructure of the health systems in these nations in all over Africa is inferior when you compare it to the infrastructure in more developed nations. And that's just a fact. So the ability to basically understand, isolate, and quarantine patients who potentially have this is somewhat restricted in these countries. So you have a greater chance of it spreading within these countries before it's actually come into check.
Trying to stop Ebola is very noble, no matter who you work for. But why is the U.S. Army so particularly interested in this?
That's a great question. So I work for the U.S. Army, the Department of Defense. I'm a U.S. government employee. And the reason why the U.S. Army is interested in this is we are always concerned that we'll have to send service members and service member families into regions where this particular virus or other viruses and bacteria of this nature are present. So there's that possibility. And then actually, if you look back in history and read books, in the 1980s, it was known before the fall of the Iron Curtain that the Russians were actually weaponizing virus like this. So we have a biothreat component that we're also interested in combating in case that happened.
Dr. John Dye, Chief of the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, Viral Immunology Branch, talking with International Edition Susan Yockey. Coming up, making a mint in mint. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Dementia affects many millions of mostly older people. The disease can be overwhelming to patients and caregivers. But in Australia, patients in facilities around Tasmania are getting visits from some new four-legged friends, courtesy of Delta Therapy Dogs.
It's very relaxing, they mellow, they start chatting, they talk to the dog very often first, and then they'll talk to us. The dog's obviously more important.
Care coordinator Dave Dunkerley says that therapy dogs have a calming effect on dementia patients.
Particularly with dementia, you can get some undesirable behaviours at times, and of course they can't help it, but the dogs tend to lessen the behaviours.
According to the World Health Organization, there are about 47 million people worldwide living with dementia, a number that's expected to double in 20 years. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
You- You're listening to VOA's International Edition in Washington. While apples, corn, and cranberries top the list of fall produce in the United States, it's also the time to harvest gum, candy, and toothpaste, or at least the oil that makes them minty fresh. Erica Celeste has details about the mint harvest from the Midwest city of South Bend, Indiana.
Walking into one of Randy Mathis's fields at Shady Lane Farms is like unwrapping a giant piece of mint gum. The fresh scent permeates the air, clings to clothing, and sticks with you for hours.
So we grow peppermint and spearmint, and there's two types of spearmint. There's what they call the native spearmint, and then they have a Scotch, what they call a Scotch spearmint.
Mathis's great-grandfather started growing mint here in the 1930s. The farm has expanded since then, but the family still grows the same strain of Black Mitcham peppermint brought over from Great Britain in the 1700s. Alicia Rogers with Indiana's Agriculture Support Office explains that the crop is treated similar to hay.
It's essentially cut, usually one cutting a year. So it's cut, let lay on the ground for about 2 days, and then they come along and harvest it with basically chopper wagons.
The chopped plants are blown into the wagon. Inside are five long pipes. At the distillery, steam is forced into the pipes.
The oil is in the leaves, so that steam bursts the oil glands in the leaves, carries the oil out into vapor form. The vapor goes through what we call the condensers.
Last year, Mathis harvested 60,000 pounds of oil. Mint isn't traded on the stock exchange like other crops. Instead, a broker who contracts directly with growers buys it. Because mint is such a specialized crop which needs expensive customized equipment, fewer and fewer farmers are planting it.
There's about 280 or so growers in the U.S. that produce this peppermint and spearmint that, kind of help flavor the world.
Those U.S. growers currently supply 70% of the world's mint needs, with the industry valued at more than $200 million a year. China, India, and Japan are important markets for mint, not only for sweets, but for home remedies.
Been great to kind of treat headaches, help with kind of colds.
Mathis notes that because of the crop's high demand and high cost, more and more manufacturers are developing synthetic mints.
I want people to know to look on the label of that chewing gum or that whatever mint-flavored product. Does it say natural flavor on it, or does it say artificial?
If that label is from Wrigley, Colgate, or Nestle, there's a good chance you're tasting some of Mathis's mint. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in South Bend, Indiana.
A new musical based on the lives and music of Gloria and Emilio Estefan opens in New York tomorrow. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the show called On Your Feet looks at the groundbreaking Grammy-winning couple who gave the world hits such as Conga, 1-2-3, and Get On Your Feet.
Ana Villafañe is a lifelong fan of Gloria Estefan. She even attended the same Miami, Florida high school as the seven-time Grammy-winning singer, Our Lady of Lourdes Academy. Now she gets to work with and to portray the star in the new musical, On Your Feet. Villafañe learned of a Miami open casting call last year, but was not able to attend. She sent the casting office a video audition, and within 3 days was called to audition for the Estefans and Tony-winning director, Jerry Mitchell. Ana says that the role, her Broadway debut, is not only the fulfillment of a dream, but also a big responsibility.
I mean, to be chosen to play this part and to step into these shoes, it's a huge deal, you know, because she's not just who she is, and it's not because she's a star, and it's not because she's such a diva, which she rightfully is. It's more because I think of the person that she is and what she represents to so many people, to not just the Latin community, I think on the world stage, because she broke a lot of barriers in being herself. And in being herself without being a stereotype and without being cliche.
The musical also stars Josh Segarra as Emilio Estefan. Segarra says that he has seen the cultural barriers shift in theater, where Latin actors and actresses are not defined by their ethnicity and don't have to fit into stereotypical roles.
We now get to play characters that happen to be Latino, they happen to be Cuban, and happen to be El Salvadorian, and happen to be Puerto Rican, and it's not defining us anymore. So to get to play a man that has broken walls, that's broken barriers, that's an honor. You know, I get to kind of live through that a little bit. I get to say some pretty important stuff in this show. We get to share some pretty important moments in this show, and we get to live it every night. So as an artist, you can only grow from that.
Ana Villafañe says the play shows some of the struggles the Estefans went through to stay true to their identity and to their vision.
You know, she tells me stories all the time about when she would get somewhere and, you know, certain concert venues would be like, oh, we want to put, like, you know, fruits on your head and, like, you know, red lipstick and this and that, and just the what you would stereotypically think. And she would say, no, I'm going out in leather and I'm going out in chaps, and she kind of, you know, she didn't have to be any certain mold. She created one.
On Your Feet features choreography by four-time Drama Desk Award nominee and Olivier Award winner Sergio Trujillo. The book is by Academy Award winner Alexander Dinilaris. The score includes original orchestrations by Gloria and Emilio Estefan, and several members of the original Miami Sound Machine are in the orchestra. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What drives people, especially young men and women, to join brutal and exploitative terrorist groups like ISIL or Boko Haram? We must better understand these drivers if we are to counteract the ability of terrorists to recruit new members and prevent the formation of similar groups in the future. Individuals, even entire communities, may align with violent extremist groups for many complex reasons. Those who feel marginalized by society on the basis of politics, religious convictions, social or economic status, or other grievances may find terrorist propaganda persuasive and look to find meaning and acceptance within terrorist groups, which often provide a storyline that allows them to turn to violence and inflicted on the society that had not fully accepted them. On a higher level, individuals and communities may seek meaning in radical ideologies and those who espouse them that seem to meet their needs for a purpose or identity. This means that in order to blunt the appeal of violent terrorist groups, we must find ways to fill unmet human needs. These can range from providing security to expanding economic options to giving marginalized communities a greater stake in determining their political future, said Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights Sarah Sewell. So we are increasing our work toward an approach to countering violent extremism that better prevents individuals and communities from wanting to align with terrorism in the first place. This includes building trust. It includes empowering a broader range of people, including civil society, businesses, religious leaders, women, youth, international bodies, and former violent extremists, to counter the false promises of groups such as ISIL and build more resilient communities. And it involves building a network of global partners, including regional and multilateral institutions such as the Arab League, United Nations, World Bank, African Union, and World Economic Forum, to reinforce the civilian-led components of this approach. In short, if we can remove or lessen the most insistent factors that motivate people to turn toward violence, then we can start replacing destructive ideas that uphold terrorism as a means of change with an avenue toward individual and community improvement and hope for a better future. As President Barack Obama said, "Ideologies are not defeated with guns. They're defeated by better ideas, a more attractive and compelling vision."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.